Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. The findings which I'm going to present to you this afternoon are from a study I did as a partial completion for my doctoral studies in South Sudan. So it's just a portion of the findings, but there are some other major findings which came out of that research. So the outline of my presentation, I'm going to talk about context, research question, methods, results, conclusions, and what I felt are my perspectives for way forward. So South Sudan, as probably some of you may know, is recovering from a 21-year-old war. And Sudan as a country is basically a country which has been at war with itself for so many years. So the war I'm going to discuss is just the one from 1983 to 2004. So you find that in post-war South Sudan, they're experiencing some of the worst health indicators in the world, in the sense that the healthcare system was completely destroyed for so many years of war, and you know, the technical staff are virtually not there, infrastructure is not there, accessibility to health facilities were all destroyed. So basically, the government of South Sudan is trying to build the health infrastructure from ground up, where there's really nothing. Now, when you take women's health and add on to all those other contextual issues, you find that women's health are mainly affected by most of the cultural practices in the region, polygamy, wife inheritance, marriage, and bride wealth, which I'm going to talk about. There's high illiteracy rates among women and very limited access to health services. And in terms of some health indicators, reproductive health specific, according to the government of South Sudan, a household survey was done in 2006, and we find that maternal mortality ratio is right now estimated to be one of the highest in the world, 2054 out of 100,000 live births. Births attended by skilled attendants are very low, only 10%, which we thought is actually really high, because if you work there, it should be a little lower if you know the health facilities in the region. Contraceptive prevalence rates are 3.5%, and total fertility rates are 6.7 births per woman. Now, abortion complications are some of the most significant reproductive health problems among Southern Sudanese women. It's estimated that at gynecology units, you find that 5 to 7 daily admissions are abortion-related, both spontaneous and induced abortions. And so in that context, my research question when I went into this, I wanted to find out what the experiences of women were of abortion complications, spontaneous or induced, in the post-war context of South Sudan. And basically, I got into this because I realized that there are no studies which had been done in Sudan, and basically because of war, and I had worked in Sudan during the war, and I was going back after the war. So the impetus for doing this study was to inform NGOs, the government, on the best ways of implementing reproductive health services, but taking into consideration the voices of women, because they are going through that experience, so that they can tell us what is it and what kinds of programs can be effective under those circumstances. So the methods I used, because there are no studies like I've mentioned, I decided to do a qualitative descriptive design using purposive sampling technique. And we identified women for interviews because they were experiencing an abortion complication and they had been admitted at the gynecology unit where I conducted the study. And participants were recruited to the study after receiving a post-abortion care. So I conducted this study in one of the 10 states in Southern Sudan, Central Equatoria, at a gynecology unit in Yei County Hospital, which is one of the major hospitals in South Sudan. And the study was conducted between March 2nd and April 26th. So that's just a picture of the Yei County Hospital as it is right now. And that's the gynecology unit where I conducted the study. It's basically a very small unit. I think it's approximately 10 beds, but most often times you find the admissions are more than the 10 beds as expected. The study went through the ethical reviews, Boston College, where I did my doctoral studies, and the government of South Sudan also approved it. I collected data via in-depth interviews. Interview guide was prepared. I used translators because at that time, populations were just returning into various parts of South Sudan. South Sudan has about 64 different ethnic groups. So it was very difficult to tell which ethnic group specifically lives where, because there were still a lot of movements going on. So I decided to use translators, and during the study I realized that among the women whom I interviewed, they represented 10 different languages. So it would have been impossible even to imagine which language was going to be prominent during the study. So I talked to 26 women who had been treated for abortion complications, and I also had some key informant interviews with a few health workers and some traditional birth attendants. Data was analyzed via coding, and I used Envivo 8 software to analyze data. So in terms of the results, demographic characteristics, most of the women I interviewed were very young. Majority were young adults and adolescents, less than 24 years of age. Average age was 23 years, and the youngest was 15, who actually I thought looked 14, and the oldest was 38. But most important about age, they really did not know their dates of birth. So most of them, the age they were giving me was what they thought, you know, they were estimated when they were refugees. An NGO looked at them and said, probably you are 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is. But only I think about 3 could tell me specifically what their dates of birth was. In terms of marital status, almost all of them, you know, 25 of them were married at that young age, and the only one person, the only one woman who was not married was engaged to be married. They had very low education level. Only 12 of them had gone to school between 1 to 8 years, and only 4 had reached 12 years of school, and about 10 of them had no schooling at all. And the ones who had gone to school had actually gone to school during displacement when they were refugees in refugee camps. And majority of them had been displaced either as refugees or IDPs. Sorry, there's a misspelling there, IPDs. And some of them, about 6, had never been displaced because they were interior of Sudan. So the 3 key findings which I'd like to discuss in this presentation, one of them was what came out, you know, after talking to women, is that a female child in South Sudan has a special role, and that role is to get married. Bride wealth is paid for them, you know, try to attract a high bride wealth. And once you are married, you have to fulfill the reproductive function, which is very central to women in South Sudan. Second, first trimester spontaneous abortion was a common reason, or in other words, stated by the women that they were experiencing a spontaneous abortion. When I went to this, I thought that participants were really going to complain about the post-war situation and how that is affecting them and access to care, etc. But that did not come out. They did not relate the post-context situation in South Sudan, the post-war context, and the abortion they were experiencing, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So I wanted to ask them also, what did they think was causing the pregnancy loss? And 3 main factors came out. One was sexually transmitted infections. A large majority thought that syphilis was causing the abortion. Heavy physical work. Most Southern Sudanese women work a lot, and they also attributed the abortion to that. And some of them also thought the family curse related to payment of bride wealth was causing the abortion, and that's the presentation I'm having this afternoon. So the role of bride wealth in South Sudan, you find that payment of bride wealth is very fundamental in any marriage. And bride wealth, basically, to define it a little bit, bride wealth is the amount of money, cash, or property which is usually transferred from the relatives of the groom to the relatives of the bride. And it's very common, it's not unique to South Sudan alone. In most African societies, you find that when women are getting married, even now, you are expected to pay bride wealth. So it's an event which is practiced. In South Sudan, payment of bride wealth is for legitimization of marriage. A marriage is not considered legal until your husband's relatives pay bride wealth to your family. It confers conjugal rights. Once bride wealth is paid, your husband has a right to have sex with you whenever and wherever he wants, and that's just a given. And also the children, within that marriage, children are affiliated more to the husband, and you find that very common in patriarchal societies Where bride wealth is very common, the man has a right to his children. So, for example, if a divorce were to happen, the woman will go away, but you leave the children behind because the man paid bride wealth. And usually, whenever there's a divorce in that kind of an arrangement, bride wealth is supposed to be returned. But if children have already been delivered, then they don't return the bride wealth. It also keeps the marriage stable in the sense that most often there are large amounts of, for example, cows are paid. And these cows are supposed to be shared among your relatives, your uncles, your aunties. And you find that over time, the cows have exchanged hands, and it's very difficult to return them whenever marriage is being dissolved. So you find that notion alone really keeps marriages stable. And there have been stories, for example, in South Sudan, where women have run away from their marriages, and the parents return them back by force because they cannot be able to return the bride wealth which was already paid for her. So it's like a catch-22 for the woman. It's also for compensation of loss of labor to the bride's family, because when a woman is married, you are supposed to transfer the labor to your husband's family. So therefore, if your family was benefiting from you in terms of labor, they are no longer going to benefit. Therefore, it's being paid. And there are other benefits too, or other reasons why bride wealth is paid. And another important one, which is also very interesting, is the sense that they are building alliances. When you marry to another family, now you are bringing new relations, you are building bridges with other clans, and that's very important for those societies. So in terms of reproductive health for women in this region, you find that bride wealth equals burden of reproduction. Once bride wealth is paid, there's a heavy burden on the woman to try and reproduce as much as possible. And throughout the interviews I was having with these women, because, like I mentioned earlier, I wanted to really find out what their experiences were so that we can be able to have programs around their experiences and what they thought were recommendations. But their preoccupation was with their reproductive function. They had had an abortion, they wanted to get well soon, they wanted to find out why they had an abortion so that they can be able to conceive again and deliver a healthy baby. So, like one of the key informants mentioned, in South Sudan, women don't have rights. Women are considered important, are not considered important. They are not entitled to any decision making. Women are not educated and have lots of problems. They are expected to deliver children every year, and basically it's tied directly to the bride wealth which is paid for them. So bride wealth, family curse, and abortion, you find that marriage process in South Sudan is not an individual decision. As I've mentioned, if you have somebody to marry you, both your parents, first of all, have to give you an okay that it's okay to marry that person. Then the relatives around your parents, your uncles, your aunties, everybody who has had a stake in your upbringing is supposed to say it's okay to marry that man. So you find marriage of a daughter is an economic exchange event in the sense that all your relatives who are involved are supposed to benefit from the bride wealth which is paid for you during marriage. So a husband and his relatives must meet the obligation to pay the agreed amount of wealth. There are usually negotiations back and forth on the amount which is supposed to be paid, and it does not have to be paid in one installment. You could agree that it's going to be 100 cattle, and you pay them over a period of time, but you must meet the amount which has been agreed upon. So you find that family curse is taken very seriously, particularly in marriages. And a curse is basically just a speech act, an expression which is given for something evil to befall you, or bad luck, or something bad is supposed to happen. And it's usually, it has to be somebody in authority which is accepted by the society that if that person curses you, something happens. So you find that in African societies, we respect our elders, our parents, and if there's anything within the culture which you are not supposed to do against your family, you respect it because of the curse which may befall you, and marriage is one example of that. So I wanted to find out, what were the reasons why these women thought that they had been cursed within their marriages? And four main reasons came out. One of them was a marriage was not sanctioned by the bride's parents. Bride wealth was not paid, or was paid but not shared among the bride's relatives. Couple have children, but bride wealth has never been paid. And bride wealth was paid but not completed. So in terms of marriage not being sanctioned, you find that, like I've mentioned, marriage has to be sanctioned. So if the bride chose to get married to somebody from another tribe, which is not accepted by people from her tribe, then that can cause a curse in her marriage. So you find, like one of them was saying, in our culture, if a relative is not happy about the marriage, the pregnancy can come out. Bloodwealth was not shared among the bride's relatives. And you find in this situation, usually sometimes something happens with the nuclear family. Either the father went to war, or the father died, or the parents divorced. And the girl's uncles brought her up or took care of her for a number of years. And if they do that, they expect that one day when you get married, they are going to benefit from your marriage by getting paid the bride wealth. So you find in this case, the father went and took the bride wealth but never shared it with the family, other family members. So in that case, the uncles can also curse the marriage of the girl because they did not share. But when this girl was growing up and making her into a good woman, these uncles took part in her upbringing. Some instances also where, you know, people got married and for some reason, the man was not rich enough to pay bride wealth immediately and said, I'm going to pay, as you know, there are other reasons why I can't pay now, but I've agreed and I'm going to pay. But you find when people get married, the woman gives birth and all of a sudden probably she has 4 children and there's no bride wealth coming. In that situation, the father can tell the woman not to give birth. They'll tell you, you know, you're married to this man, he has not paid us anything, you already have 4 children with him, please don't have other children. But it's very interesting. Family planning is not part of this presentation, but if you read literature or if you talk to people who've worked in South Sudan, family planning is not really well embraced. So when your family tells you not to give birth, you already have 4 children, it's difficult because how are you supposed to protect yourself from getting pregnant again? It becomes very difficult. So you find in these situations, women continue giving birth, the parent is unhappy, they believe they are cursed, and they, you know, they feel that they should not give birth, but they don't know how. Then, bride wealth was paid but not completed. Families where women have been married and bride wealth was never completed is a source of sadness for the bride's parents, because bride wealth being paid for your daughter is a source of pride in the community, in the village, and everybody respects you. So if you gave birth to a woman or a lady and she got married and bride wealth was never paid for her, that's a source of ridicule for your family within that society. So it becomes very bad and your father can curse you until your husband's relatives pay. Now, I wanted to see why, you know, they did not relate the post-war context with abortion complication. And basically, they were just happy that the war was ended. And I think part of it I was reasoning, because if you worked in Sudan during the war, things were horrible because it's a war which went on for a very long time. So when it ended, a lot of things happened because people became free, they were able to travel, and that could have been a reason. Another reason could be because these people were very young. I've said most of them were less than 24 years of age. They grew up in displacement, and probably they really don't relate to that war the way their mothers relate to it. So it's not very easy for them to connect what they are going on with, what's going on in their body with the post-war context per se. Most of them whom I spoke with related what they were feeling post-abortion with the bride wealth payment. And some of them were deeply sad because they felt that when a pregnancy ends out of abortion, it's like death of a real person. Because once you get married and you become pregnant, they already start treating, you know, the fetus as a real human being, and some of them already give it a name. So when you lose it via an abortion, then that's really a source of sadness. And some of them, pregnancy ending was very personal, because abortions, if you're a woman who cannot keep a pregnancy, is a source of stigma, is a source of ridicule, and is a source of shame, because if bride wealth is paid, then you're supposed to give your husband children, and if you don't, then it's really, really not, you know, a time of, for happiness for the ladies. So like one participant was saying, I feel sad with this husband, I have no child. The firstborn I delivered, the child died. Now I try to conceive, the pregnancy came out. Really, will I get a child in the future? Some of them felt they were being blamed, or there's blame and rejection. Because if you're a woman, like I said, the central responsibility is reproduction. So when you are pregnant, you are supposed to take care of that pregnancy. Of course, you get help within, you know, your aunties and your in-laws, but the primary responsibility is to make sure that you carry that pregnancy to term and you give birth to a live baby. If you are sick, you are supposed to seek care immediately. And some of them also feared rejection from the one's family because you are not able to give birth to justify for the amount of bride wealth they paid for you. So one of them said, I'm worried because he called me today. He said he's coming, and if he finds his pregnancy's out, he does not want me. He wants me to go back to my home. So some of those were those kinds of feeling. So in terms of conclusion, abortion-related complications are number one among admissions in that county hospital, Yei County Hospital. First trimester spontaneous abortions were very common for women who are married young, although among the women who were interviewed, I thought that probably one or two may have been induced, but I had no way of confirming that. But majority, given their, you know, the way they were expressing themselves, the verbal, the body language, they were truly spontaneous abortions. Marriage and bride wealth plays a very important role among Southern Sudanese culture, especially in women's lives, and it puts a lot of pressure on women to reproduce. So women's status and cultural context has implications to healthcare policy, planning, and delivery in South Sudan. So my perspectives for way forward, I think that to achieve social justice for Southern Sudanese women, we need innovative interventions which are targeting young married women, because in South Sudan, most women marry very young, and interventions should be peer-driven, culturally relevant and acceptable. It should address not only health issues, but some of the life skills which they can be able to deal with within this cultural context. Economic empowerment is very important, and we need to listen to women's voices and perspectives. We need to involve men and community leaders for any reproductive health to be truly successful in these communities. Further research is also needed to understand the interactions of Southern Sudanese cultural context with various reproductive health outcomes, such as abortion complications. Study limitations, being a qualitative design, and I only interviewed 26 women, it's not possible to generalize, but it gives us some insight, things, you know, we can consider moving forward. Interviews were conducted using translators. This may have affected accurate representation of participant description of events. And I also thought probably it would have been nice if I talked to the husbands too, to realize, to hear what their perspectives are. So I thought that was kind of a weakness. And I would like to acknowledge a few people who helped me through the research, funding, my dissertation committee, the government of South Sudan, the hospital where I worked, research participants and assistants. And there are some few people who have also done some work related to women's situations and have alluded to issues around bride wealth. If somebody is interested, those are also some sources we can look for. Thank you.
Body left, I just think that they, maybe the younger women, the adolescents, they were really just trying. They really did want the pregnancy, but then maybe they just didn't think to remove whatever was there before they went to the healthcare facility. So maybe it was there's potentially an older woman who will have no other women who have already done this, and then they would say, no, but make sure you take out anything before you go into the healthcare facility because they may treat you more poorly because of that.
So it's patient level data from the provider's perspective, it was the case record data, not patient record.
Right. We didn't conduct the interviews with him women because although post-abortion care is legal, it's still stigmatized, and so we didn't want we wanted to make sure that the data that we collected was the best data we could collect, and so we thought that having the provider fill it out would be the most helpful.
I'm going to ask an obvious question. I'm from Canada, so maybe this has already been debated in the caucus, but you presented data that was either looked fabricated or not your data. and recommendations for clear scrutiny. I'm just wondering, what's your explanation for those incredibly strange findings that you could replicate but others haven't? What story do you tell about that?
I have been involved in pre-analysis of another sort of data set that they work with, and I had originally attributed.
Can you speak up?
Oh, sorry.
Microphone, please.
So I actually have been involved in another reanalysis paper of the National Survey of Family Growth, but it was a Cycle 5 data collection, looking at the relationship of abortion and anxiety, and there also had seemed to be some miscoded things with that particular group of authors. And I just sort of attributed it to, you know, sloppiness. It's a big data set. And with this this particular data set, to be honest, I just really don't know how they got such drastically different findings, and it's not just with me. As I said, it's with many other studies that have, you know, looked at, they haven't looked at abortion and mental health in this data set, but they've looked at, like, the prevalence of mental health among women, and they used, right, all women in their data set. They just divided women into abortion versus no abortion, and so we would expect, right, that the average of those two would be the average of all women. And so it's not. So my take on this is just that they were just, you know, I can't say what they were doing, really. What I can do is, you know, show this to the editors of the journal in which it was published in. But I can't really speak to what precisely was going on with them. You know, I tried contacting them. You know, when I was doing these analysis a couple times, and I just got no response.
Interesting. Do you know who funds their work?
Excuse me?
Do you know who funds their work?
Oh, well, I know that. No, well, I do know one of. So David Reardon is someone that Coleman frequently publishes with. He was not on this particular paper that I rebutted. But he is funded by, he has his own organization called the Elliott Institute, located in Springfield, Illinois, which is funded by anti-abortion organizations.
So I understand that, but it seemed quite improved by the third month, and I'm wondering where those interventions are happening or what explanation there is for that.
In what context was it improved? General?
Just generally, yeah. It just looked to be improved very generally across the board.
You know, I'm not sure. I'm just looking at the data, and I'm not working in clinics or other healthcare facilities, so I'm not sure. I mean, I think it makes sense in that, of course, with time in 3 months, there's a lot more room for interventions, be it for an individual to access such care or subsequent follow-ups or whatnot. So, I mean, I think it makes sense logically, but again, I do think those numbers are alarming, and I think it's important to increase that access to contraception in the 1 month period as well as the third. But I don't know if anyone else has feedback who might.
Yeah, I have a question on Malawi then. In Malawi, they got say that two-thirds of those ones who report abortion were young adults, and then say the majority of them also married. Did you know what type of partnership was it? Legal marriage, was it traditional marriage, was it the cohabitation type of thing? Because that also defines the type of security you have in that particular partnership.
Right, so it was that that 50% of the women were young adults under 25 years, not two-thirds. But we saw that 81% were married, and that was that they said that they told their provider that they were married. So I don't have information about if it was a traditional marriage. That's interesting, because the DHS doesn't distinguish between different types of marriage in Malawi either. So if I'm not mistaken, the DHS just says if they're married or not. So I'll have to go back and see. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think that your study in Southern Sudan is a lesson for us all to think about. One of the areas where I don't think we do a lot of good work is around infertility, whether it's primary or secondary infertility. And I think often in the post-abortion care context, we tend to focus on the need to get contraception in there, and we sort of lose track of the women for whom pregnancy loss is a sad event rather than an active or agent event. And I just think it really speaks to where the silence is in post-abortion care, that for many of these women, some were induced, but there was also, it seemed like, a significant number of women who were experiencing spontaneous abortion, and that was not a desired outcome. And I feel like it's a silence that maybe needs a little bit more voice, and I hope your presentation can help raise that voice in the post-abortion context, so we don't forget about the women who have unfulfilled fertility desires.
Yeah, I think that's a good comment. And I think for me, it's just broadening the discussion and being able to understand the context where we are working. Because when I was doing the study, and every time I've presented it with the high numbers of spontaneous abortions, everybody's like, how do you know they were telling you the truth? And how do you know that some of them were not induced? Which could be true, but you know, the context of women in that situation needs to be considered, because then it's able to direct our programs appropriately. So yeah, thanks, that's a good comment.
Just a couple more questions. Just over 4 o'clock, but is there any other question, please? In that case, I want to thank you.